and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, President Trump on Wednesday reaffirmed his opposition to routine annual joint U.S.-South Korean military drills, a move that has infuriated South Korean conservatives, but which was supported by President Moon Jae-in. Although the move will make the North Koreans happy, it could create a significant political backlash for Moon. Next, Bank of America is facing a backlash after freezing the accounts of people who have not proven their U.S. citizenship or permanent resident status. The bank says that it has always asked customers about their citizenship, but it's begun unfreezing accounts after admitting that there are no federal laws or regulations that require it to do so. Then, over the past decade, New York City has made reductions in the number of children in public housing who tested positive for lead. But that ended when the city stopped inspecting apartments for lead paint. Lead levels are on the rise, not just in New York, but in cities across the country, including Washington, D.C. And then, yesterday, the city of El Paso, Texas, dissolved an injunction, leaving a neighborhood in El Paso up for demolition to make way for an arena. Barrio Duranguito is now under 24-hour watch to protect the buildings by Paso del Sur, a community group, and you can find them at facebook.com/Paso del Sur EP. And finally, it's Friday, so we'll look at the week's worst and most misleading headlines. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Korea. President Trump on Wednesday reaffirmed his opposition to routine annual joint U.S.-South Korean military drills, a move that has infuriated South Korean conservatives, but which was supported by President Moon Jae-in. Although the move will make the North Koreans happy, it could create a significant political backlash for Moon. We're joined from Arlington, Virginia by Gareth Porter. He's an historian, investigative journalist, and analyst specializing in U.S. national security policy. Gareth is also the author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Welcome back, Gareth.
Hey, hello, John. Hello, Brian. Glad to be back.
Let's start with the New York Times article about this this issue this morning. It was very, very deceiving. It made the reader think, in my opinion, that there's this mass movement among South Korean citizens to oppose this policy. In fact, if you read the article, it seems like it was only retired South Korean generals who were opposed to the policy.
Well, you know, I think you're absolutely right, John. And I've been tracking the New York Times coverage of this issue very closely in the last few months, last several months. And indeed, the Times has a bug up somewhere about this issue, trying to convince the readers of the Times that, in fact, South Korea's President Moon Jae-in is pursuing an unpopular policy toward the North that is scaring many, as they put it, many South Koreans, whereas in fact we know that there has been a public opinion poll in South Korea which shows that after the summit meeting between Moon and Kim Jong-un, Moon's population reached 83% of the people in South Korea who were polled. That's a remarkable figure for any foreign policy, or if you want to call it an internal policy of South Korea. And it shows that the Times is, as you point out, John, is being very deceptive in this, in creating the sense or the illusion that South Koreans are upset with Moon over this. In fact, it's a very small minority of the population, represented, as you said, by retired generals and others who have a vested interest in this because they are afraid, in fact, that peace between North and South Korea will have some effect on their cozy relationship with the U.S. military, with all the perks and other things that go with that. So I think it's very clear that this is a storyline that the Times has been pushing because they are trying to sabotage the Trump support for North-South accord and even more importantly, support for an agreement of some sort with North Korea, although it may well be in trouble. That's another question. But the Times has been campaigning, and this is only the latest, and I would say perhaps the most outrageous case of its coverage.
Yeah, Gareth Porter is our guest. The headline actually reads this. This is the New York Times full-page headline from side to side. pause in joint exercises worries South Koreans. Now, these, it's completely misleading. The South Koreans, as John and as Gareth has mentioned, is just, they're quoting think tanks and some retired generals. I mean, these are exercises that simulate the destruction, the annihilation of North Korea, a country that was, in fact, annihilated by the United States during the Korean War. The main complaint of American pilots by January 1951, which was about 10 months into the war, was that there was nothing left to bomb because everything was destroyed. There wasn't one structure taller than one story still standing by then. And that then the U.S. continued to bomb for the next 2 years. And now James Mattis had said the other day or suggested we're no longer considering a suspension of military exercises. The Times, certainly John McCain, by the way, Jim Mattis is going to be a pallbearer for John McCain. All of these people oppose peace breaking out in the Korean Peninsula. Gareth Porter, how come? I mean, all wars have a beginning. This one just doesn't seem to have an end. Why not?
It doesn't have an end because of the vested interests that are tied up in the status quo. There's no question about this, and it becomes clear with every passing month that there are tremendous interests involving the U.S. national security state, which, as well as the political elite and the media elite, all of whom want to keep things precisely the way they are because they all have interests that are bound up in keeping this present situation of U.S. Military hegemony in Northeast Asia, as witnessed by the continued U.S. military presence in South Korea so many decades after the end of the war. And more importantly, of course, from the point of view of the U.S. military, the bases in Japan and Okinawa, part of Japan, of course, but bases and naval presence in the Northeast Asia region, which are viewed as the bastion of U.S. military power in Asia, and really the signal of U.S. Dominance in East Asia, which they're very much afraid will be influenced by the outcome of the peace process between North and South Korea, and they're opposed to U.S. signing a peace treaty with North Korea and to end the Korean War. There's absolutely no reason rationally why that shouldn't be done. But in terms of the politics, the political and military interests that are involved, of course, this is something the U.S. military brass generally and the various political and media elites in this country are very much worried about.
The United Nations command in South Korea, which is still led by Americans. I mean, here we are. The war started in 1950 because the Soviets weren't then in the Security Council. They were boycotting to demand the People's Republic of China, which had just had a revolution, have the China seat in the Security Council. So since the U.S. was blocking that, the Soviets withdrew. And because they weren't there, the U.S. could then pass a resolution authorizing the U.N. to go to war against North Korea. The U.N. command, Gareth, is still there and still operational. Moon Jae-in, the leader of South Korea, and Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, had this summit at the end of April in Panmunjom, in the demilitarized zone between the two Koreas, and they agreed that they were going to start working together, start to normalize relations, maybe even leading to reunification. And they wanted to have a railroad line that links South Korea to North Korea. And guess what? Just this week, the UN command, which is the United States, has disapproved of Koreans building a railroad between North and South Koreans. I mean, you can't beat that for imperial arrogance.
Well, you know, it's not just arrogant. It's absolutely foolish, and it's nonsensical in terms of the actual military situation on the Korean Peninsula. And this is a point that I'm sorry to say the U.S. news media continues to obscure and do its best to essentially deny. But the reality has been for decades now that North Korea does not have anything like a real capability to invade the South and actually avoid being pushed back within days and losing everything. So there is no serious thought being given to the possibility of reunification by force by the North, despite the drumbeat of propaganda that insists that that's the case. And serious military analysts, both those that have been in the U.S. military and those outside don't really disagree on this, that the North has lost its ability to impose any military solution on the South, or even to have any chance of winning a war in the South, that they would be soundly defeated even without any U.S. military intervention, because the South is so far superior to them in conventional weaponry. The North has not had any modernization of their weaponry, of their tanks, and all the rest of the heavy weaponry in 3 or 4 decades now. I think it's more like 4 decades. They're relying on 1970s technology. So this is not a serious problem. And this is, I think, the truth that has been covered up now for a long time by the U.S. media.
Gareth Porter, we have 1 minute left. It seems to me that the only person who's really fighting for this peace process in Washington is Donald Trump. I mean, maybe for his own personal reasons. I don't know. Who knows exactly what he's thinking? But you have the Democrats against it, most of the Republicans. It seems like Mattis is against it. Certainly John Bolton wants to blow it up. Maybe Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State. But if Trump weren't here, or if Trump isn't here, either because he's not reelected or something else happens like impeachment or whatever, does this process end?
You know, I almost hate to admit it, because I'm no admirer of Donald Trump, to say the least. But I'm afraid it's true that if any other president, Republican sort of nominal centrist Republican or centrist Democrat had been elected as president, we would certainly not be looking at an issue of making peace with North Korea at this point.
Yeah, it's an oddity, certainly. We, too, here oppose most of Donald Trump's policies, but I think he seems like the only one who's actually for this. Moon Jae-in and Kim Jong-un are for it. The North and South Korean people are undoubtedly for it, but that's the status of things. They actually are not able to fully determine their own destiny.
We're not able to do that either, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true.
We hear you. We hear you.
That was the voice of Gareth Porter, who joined us from Arlington, Virginia. Gareth is a historian, investigative journalist, and analyst specializing in U.S. national security policy, and he's also the author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Bank of America is facing a backlash after freezing the accounts of people who have not proven their U.S. citizenship or permanent resident status. The bank says that it has always asked its customers about their citizenship, but it's begun unfreezing accounts after admitting that there are no federal laws or regulations that require it to do so. We're joined from San Francisco by Richard Becker. He's the author of The Myth of Democracy and the Rule of the Banks. Welcome back.
Thanks very much, John.
You know, I was surprised, Dick, at how Bank of America today only half-heartedly pushed back at this. Even if they have always done this, it seems like it's changed a little bit in that they're freezing accounts first, and then saying, you have to prove to us that you're Americans or that you're here on a green card. What do you make of this?
Well, just because Bank of America is the largest bank in the United States with more than $3 trillion in assets doesn't mean they don't want your bank account too, and they'd like to take over as many as possible. I mean, I think that we should look at the Bank of America and the other big banks as really criminal enterprises. They've engaged in so much criminality and so much of what is semi-legal, but then is granted to them by a government that is really beholden to and subservient to the banks.
Right. And is this unique to Bank of America, or are other banks doing the same kind of thing?
Well, I mean, you could see there's a big scandal. Wells Fargo, which is based in San Francisco, where I live, you know, it has a big advertising campaign. They were established in 1852 and reestablished in 2018 based on their old values of trust and et cetera, et cetera. And it's all garbage. I mean, what did Wells Fargo do? They were opening hundreds of thousands and perhaps, I don't think we know the full extent of it, millions of accounts.
Yes.
For people who did not want those accounts.
Yeah. In fact, it wasn't unusual for people to have a half a dozen accounts at Wells Fargo that they didn't even know about.
Yeah, they had no idea that they had these accounts. And they they were set up, of course, only for the benefit of the bank. And we see the same thing. I mean, time after time after time, we see this kind of activity by these big banks, and yet there's really nothing that happens to them. When they commit the most egregious forms of fraud, they're fined. Later, the fines are reduced. They apologize. And then they do it exactly over again because they know that the fines will never, never come close to the profits they make from all kinds of fraudulent activity.
Oh, yeah. It's an economic decision. They know that the fines are going to be less than the profits, even if the profits are ill-gotten gains. And so they go for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And they are allowed to get away from it. And the pamphlet that I wrote, The Myth of Democracy and the Rule of the Banks, I mean, the thesis of it was that if you really look objectively at the situation, the government doesn't rule over the banks. The banks rule over the government.
And that's why no one was prosecuted after the economy collapsed in 2008.
Yeah, as of now, no prosecution, and not even prosecutions. There was one particularly amazing story, and that is between 2004 and 2007, a bank that collapsed, that later collapsed, laundered, and the government charged them with laundering $378 billion in Mexican drug money. That bank was taken over by Wells Fargo, and after it was taken over, they were fined $50 million, and then the next year, another $50 million. No criminal charges were brought. The case was dismissed. $100 million versus $378 billion in laundered drug money.
There was a piece in today's Huffington Post that I wanted to mention to you. It quotes two people. One is an Iranian doctoral student by the name of Saeed Moshfegh. He's at the University of Miami. He said that his account was frozen at the local Bank of America branch because they refused to accept the documentation he offered to demonstrate his status as a student. He said that he offered his student ID. He offered transcripts of his classes. And they said, not good enough. It was only because he tweeted at Bank of America that they backed off. Dan Hernandez, a television writer, also in Miami, he's of Cuban heritage. He said the bank suspended his business account because they told him he had to prove that he was not doing business with Cuba, if that makes any sense at all. And again, he tweeted at Bank of America, and they backed off and they gave him back his account. Is this something we're going to be seeing more of, or is this just a temporary situation where Bank of America went out of control and now they're being reined back in?
Well, we don't really know the scope of this. I mean, we have to say that. We have to assume, I think, that we have people like the two that you just mentioned who are, you know, people who are very aware of their rights. They're people who are highly educated. They're not taking this lying down, and so they're fighting back. But what about the thousands and thousands of other people that we have to assume the same thing is happening to? And what have the real consequences been for them? I mean, like, what if your account is frozen, you can't pay your rent, you can get evicted. How many people have been evicted? We need an investigation about all of that.
I think you're right. There was a statement made yesterday by a spokeswoman for the California Bankers Association that I think really lays it all out. She says that federal law only requires that banks ask for an account holder's name, date of birth, residence address, and social security number. That's it. They can't ask you for your student ID or your transcripts or your passport or anything else. Just name, date of birth, residential address, and social security number. Somebody has to rein the banks in. And I suspect that we're not just talking about Bank of America here. I suspect, like you do, that this is far more broad. It's happening far more widely than we yet know.
I don't think there's any question about that. And the fact that there have been no criminal prosecutions of the biggest bankers in the United States who committed fraud after fraud after fraud, crime after crime after crime in the lead up to the 2008 collapse, and then continued to do so afterwards, that none of them have been prosecuted criminally, and that the fines that are eventually paid are paid out of the corporation's accounts, not out of those executives who really preside over the criminality that goes on day in and day out.
So let me ask you, what can Americans do? How can they take care of their personal finances without going to one of these banks?
Well, it's very hard to say how to do that because the banks have become so enormous. There were 16 banks that became four in the last crisis. There's, you know, some people say, well, it's better to go to credit unions and so forth, but they're usually very, very limited in terms of convenience and availability and so forth. I think that what we really have to fight for is some way of bringing the people's control over the big bank. And that can really only be done by building a movement that says that the rights of people have to come first over the profits of the big banks and corporations.
You know, I've always wondered if any of these small regional banks are better or if we should stick with community savings and loans or any other small financial institution, even if it costs us a couple of dollars. Does it really make any difference?
You know, it's really hard to say because in the banking industry, there is a constant process of merger, collapse, another merger. I mean, the Bank of America actually just took the name Bank of America. It was originally a regional bank in North Carolina, a local bank at the beginning that grew into this bank that was big enough to be able to take over Bank of America and then put that name back on. And so we see this process happening over and over and over again, the same process of monopolization and consolidation.
Things got worse under the Obama administration, and we all know that Donald Trump is the enemy of banking regulation. Do you have any hope for any kind of new regulations or new controls? Do you have anything to tell us that we can look forward to?
Well, I think that that's true. What you just said is very, very true. And the bankers themselves, when Obama came in, when he met with them in March of 2009 to tell them the terms of them getting the bailout, they were shocked by how easy the terms were. They were like reportedly looking at each other like, okay, this is fine. So it's true. It's been the Republicans. It's been the Democrats. It's going to take a people's movement that demands real control over the banks. And really, ultimately, I think the banks are too big to fail and they're too big to exist as private enterprises. The banks need to be taken over and run in the interest of the people.
We have 30 seconds left. Give us your final thoughts on this issue.
I think that the people in the United States would be shocked to know how the banks have been treated by the government and how even when you read a headline that says Bank of America fines $16 billion, that if you really trace that story down to the end, you find out that nothing like that actually happened to them and that they have been so emboldened by government inactivity, by government laxness, by the fact that in reality that they control the government, that they suffer virtually no consequences and continue to reap enormous profits at our expense.
That was the voice of Richard Becker. He joined us from San Francisco. He's the author of The Myth of Democracy and the Rule of the Banks. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Over the past decade, New York City made steady reductions in the number of children in public housing who tested positive for lead. But that ended when the city stopped inspecting apartments for lead paint. Lead levels are on the rise, not just in New York, but in cities across the country, including Washington. We're joined from Washington by Yasmina Marabit, a housing organizer with Justice First. Yasmina is also an activist with the organization Link Up. Yasmina, welcome back. It's been a long time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. This is a very important issue. An article appeared in today's New York Times, and it was about the New York City public housing system. Tell us what's happening here in Washington.
Well, here you see the same thing. I mean, the first thing I wanted to mention regarding the New York situation is that, you know, they talk about like it being positive that the numbers were declining. It shouldn't be satisfactory that, you know, we have declining numbers of children exposed to lead over a period of time when it's a situation that could be resolved immediately. You know, like the biggest problems that tenants are facing in New York and in D.C. and, you know, in basically every other city in America is that there's no accountability. you know, for the lead exposure and other toxins that people are being exposed to in public housing and in private properties. So in D.C., I'm working with tenants at Dahlgreen Courts in Northeast D.C., where over 40 tenants have tested positive for the markers of biotoxin illness as a result to exposure to lead, mold, and other toxins. And they only know this because after years of fighting, they were finally able to find an attorney that was willing to sue the developer and the management company. And as a part of that lawsuit, this attorney, you know, fronted the money necessary to get that testing done for them. Because, you know, to actually get tested, it requires extensive blood work and it's very expensive. You can't just use, you know, any insurance or just like go to your regular doctor and get tested for a lot of these toxins. And then we just heard that in the public housing buildings at Berry Farm, the DC Housing Authority knew about lead being present in those buildings 20 years ago, and they're just informing of people of that now. And what I thought was, you know, particularly insidious was that they made a claim on the WUSA 9 show that no children have been affected. How could they possibly know that no children have been affected, first? And secondly, how could no children have possibly been affected when you know, lead dust was found present in these units? And you know, we can expect that if it was there 20 years ago and they didn't say anything, it's been there the whole time. The structures haven't changed. You know, the base of the paint that was used hasn't changed. So that's what we're looking at in D.C.
Yasmina Morabit is our guest. She's a housing organizer here in Washington, D.C. The story that sort of broke this open this morning was from the New York Times. The article says, for more than a decade, New York City made steady progress in reducing the number of children. This would be, of course, low-income children in public housing who have tested positive to lead. But shock of all shocks, the number has gone up because guess what? The housing authority, the city housing authority, stopped inspecting its apartments for lead paint. Yasmina's making the really important point that there should be a zero tolerance for lead in the bloodstream of any child. And the fact that there is lead, not just in a few children, but in hundreds of thousands of children, almost all of whom are low income from low income families, is actually a criminal act. I mean, it's a criminal act. When you poison people, when you have, as Yasmina said, this WUSA 9 report, this is Channel 9 here in Washington, D.C., the headline today, 20-year-old report reveals high level of lead in parts of the Berry Farm housing complex. The 1998 lead study was never finished and sat on a shelf for two decades until a new housing director went back in the archives. I mean, it's criminal, Yasmina. And you talked about no accountability. Some people should actually be arrested for this.
You know what? I was going to ask her about that because Washington's famous for the strength of its tenant laws. They're much stronger tenant laws than we have in both Virginia and Maryland. But we're talking about the landlord here being the city. This is public housing. It's not a privately owned apartment we're talking about. So I wanted to know, is anybody being punished? Is anybody being held to account for putting all of these lives in danger?
No, absolutely not. And they won't be. I mean, I work with tenants, for example, at Montana Terrace, where in one unit, a woman was living with a collapsed ceiling for 6 weeks. And they didn't do anything about it until we started sending out these, you know, public tweets and Facebook posts. She had contacted her council member. She had contacted the housing authority. She had so many work orders out. And it turned out that there was a heavy presence, a heavy spore count of like the most toxic types of mold that she was exposed to, she and her daughter, over a prolonged period of time. And these toxins can have serious health impacts. They can cause disease. They can cause death. You got to start thinking things are strange when you're going into all of these different units and people are all being exposed to the same toxins. And then people are all telling you about the health issues that they have. And there's all these similarities. You have entire neighborhoods of people that have been diagnosed with anxiety, depression, PTSD, people that are experiencing, you know, headaches, stomach problems, all of these different symptoms. People are going to their doctors. They're getting prescribed medications for diagnoses that are based on the symptoms, but they're never really addressing the underlying cause, which is actually the mold and the toxins that they're being exposed to in their homes that are run by, you know, these the housing authorities, which are acting as slumlords.
Yeah, and what about private landlords? What about in that realm? Because I know you're also organizing in areas, contested areas, some of them. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, again, no accountability. The only accountability is if you are able to, you got to organize, you got to find an attorney that's willing to represent you, you've got to sue them, basically. And then you've got to go through the whole litigation process, which everybody knows can take a long time. Meanwhile, you're living in these conditions and you're suffering from various health ailments as a result. And there's nothing, there's just no accountability. And it's a known fact that housing policy is determined by developers and it's determined by, you know, a profit motive, essentially. And that's both with the neglect of public housing and with the lack of accountability for private landlords. It's really a matter of allocation of resources. There should be, you know, not one more dog park built, not one more stadium built until or unless, you know, all of these issues are remedied in public housing, for example, or until or unless, you know, the necessary money is spent to remediate these issues also in private private housing, because we see the city subsidizing developers to build luxury housing all the time. Why don't they subsidize remediating mold in these buildings if they're going to give them subsidies? So this is an issue that could be fixed. But, you know, there's no political will to do so because decision-making is tied up in money-making interests.
We don't want to focus solely on lead poisoning, too. There are other very significant problems in public housing. You referred a moment ago, Yasmina, to this ceiling that had collapsed and remained collapsed for 6 weeks. I think actually Brian posted that on Facebook when it happened. What other problems do tenants in public housing face besides the lead paint, besides terrible physical plant? What's a day-to-day life look like in public housing in Washington?
And Yasmina, before you answer that, because we have just under 3 minutes, do that if you could for about 2 minutes and then talk about another model for public housing, because right now public housing looks like just infirmed housing, terrible housing, but there is another option. But answer John's question first, and then let's get to that.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I mean, there's rodent infestation, like rats eating through people's refrigerators, you know, and this is not because people are not keeping their homes clean or something like that. There's holes behind the stove, holes in the laundry closet. And all of these rodents are coming through, you know, and then you can get health issues from rodent infestation as well. So there's that. There's water damage. There's a lot of water leakages, and that's usually what's leading to the mold. There's issues with plumbing. You know, some residents like that live on bottom floors in some of the apartment buildings that are in public housing, they have to cook, you know, before, a few days before Christmas or a few days after, because if they do it at the same time as all of their neighbors, then they get a sewage backup. I mean, you know, like when it rains, it'll rain in people's apartments because there's cracks in their ceiling. There's like, in addition to the actual toxins, there are also like substances that are unidentifiable. Like in one mold report for one of the units at Montana Terrace, they said there's a brown, reddish, sticky substance that we can't identify. It's not mold, but it causes mold to grow. So there's all kinds of stuff like that. And then, you know, when people try to keep their homes clean to the extent that they can, but when you have black mold growing and you go and you clean that, you're disturbing the mold and particles are going into the air and then you're breathing them in and the rest is, you know, the rest. But in terms of public housing, I mean, public housing doesn't have to look like this. We could be investing in state-of-the-art, beautiful public housing. We could be investing in the creation of an affordable public option for the masses of people in the United States that need an affordable housing option. There are other places around the world that have this, like in Austria, for example. They have social housing. They have their public housing. There's walnut trees on the property. You can sign up to go to spas. They have pools, they have green space, they have sports facilities, everything that any community would want, except that they're publicly owned and controlled rather than being owned and controlled by the interests of private developers who just want to make as much money as possible while extracting as much as they can from renters. Meanwhile, people are struggling paying like 50, 60% of their income just to have a roof over their head. This does not make sense for us to subsidize the building of unaffordable housing when we could be spending that money to build affordable, publicly owned and controlled housing.
Absolutely right. That was the voice of Yasmina Morabit. She joined us from Washington. She's a housing organizer with Justice First and an activist with the organization Link Up. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Yesterday, the city of El Paso, Texas, withdrew an injunction leaving a neighborhood in the city up for demolition to make way for an arena. Barrio Duranguito is now under 24-hour watch by Paso del Sur, a community group, to protect the buildings. We're joined from El Paso, Texas, by Rodriga, Cynthia, and Selfa, all organizers with Paso del Sur. Welcome to all three of you.
Hi there.
Hi, thank you.
Rodriga, let's start with you. You know, we see this same thing happening in Washington. There's a neighborhood in Southeast Washington, which is a working class, poor, mostly African-American neighborhood. And blocks worth of housing was destroyed to make way for a new soccer stadium, as if we needed a soccer stadium. But it's not just in Washington. It's not just in El Paso. It's all over the country, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. These gentrification cases are very alarming, and it's very clear that they attack poor communities of color.
Let's go over with any one of you who wants to start. Like, what's actually happening right now in El Paso? Tell us a little bit about the injunction, the lifting of the injunction, what it means, and what you expect.
Okay, this is Cynthia. So yesterday, the Court of Appeals dissolved the injunction that has been in place for almost a year since the neighborhoods were attacked last September 11th and 12th. The city came by and illegally damaged historic buildings on Chihuahua Street, which is in the Barrio Duranguito neighborhood. So since last night, we have been on 24 hours alert. And I want to say that since those attacks last year, we have had and maintained some kind of presence in the neighborhood. We have kept watch by keeping and setting up a planton, which is like a camp. And so we've had the camp occupied at different levels throughout the year. So last night was another peak in those actions that we wanted to be especially vigilant because of these changes that came down from the court.
We're speaking from El Paso, Texas, by Rodriga, Cynthia, and Selfa, all organizers with Paso del Sur. And I interrupted someone just now. Go right ahead with your thought.
Yes, no problem. This is Rodriga. I just wanted to add to what Cynthia said, and she's absolutely right. So we've maintained presence here for well over a year in a camp where we are here vigilant, making sure that the buildings are taken care of, because at this point, we don't trust the city, and we also do not trust the cops, who is very clear that they have an alliance with the city and that they're not really here to protect us or protect the buildings, but protect the 1% and protect the city and those that collaborate with the city.
Brian, you're active in these kinds of issues here in the Washington area. What's your experience?
Well, they're right. I mean, this is gentrification. It's for the enrichment of landlords and developers. It's gentrifying poor people and low-income people. But it's also, I think we have to emphasize the profoundly racist character of what's going on. And I'm looking at an article in the Counterpunch from about a year ago. It's in October 2017, called The De-Mexicanization of Duranguito Barrio, El Paso, Texas. Talk about that, and what does it mean to de-Mexicanize El Paso and the history of El Paso and its connection to Mexico and Mexicans?
This is Selfa. Definitely, this has been historically a Mexican and Mexican-American neighborhood, and nevertheless, there are other residents of a very diverse background, but always racialized, always marginalized. And to the factor of race, gender and age complicates the picture. We have women who are elderly and who have built their families in this community. So definitely they want to keep their history alive. They want to continue maintaining their networks, their community networks, their traditions. And the city of El Paso, as many other cities have been trying to whiten the society in general by erasing the architectonic evidence of the contributions that the Mexican and Mexican-American communities, as well as others, have made to the economy and the culture and the history of the United States. It's like our presence is offensive. They see us as disposable and insulting to a very white ideal of how a city should look like in their eyes. So that's what the project is about. It's not only about economics, but it is also about history and memory and dignity, too.
We did a story, John, just yesterday about how the Trump administration is denying passports or passport renewals to U.S. citizens who are living in border areas because they have Latino surnames.
That's right.
And they're demanding additional proof, like show us your the where you were born and the name and residence of the midwife or the hospital 40 years earlier.
Records of your mother's prenatal care.
Yeah, things that are impossible for people to produce. And at the same time, what we're hearing is that this is not just Trump, and I want our guests to talk about it. It's part of Trump may be the leading tip of the spear of this anti-immigrant, xenophobic, racist movement. But it's bigger than Trump because there are commercial interests. There are real estate interests. And it's not just the Republican Party either. This is an assault against working class and poor and Mexican communities in this instance for the benefit of the already very, very rich. Anyway, talk about that if you would. Any one of you can jump in here.
Well, here at the local level, it's a little humorous and kind of twisted that our mayor, his name is actually Donald Margo, and the name is not just the similarity, but many of his political tactics, which gentrification, we've already mentioned, is one of them, but also attacks on immigrants, like you mentioned, which very much resemble the tactics of the president of the United States, as well as limiting free speech. Here, when we've gone to the city council meeting and we want to speak and we want to voice that there's a big number of people in favor of preserving Duranguito, not destroying it. Well, what was one of the first moves that he did against this is he limited the public speech, the public comment, from 3 minutes to 1 minute. What does that tell you about our leadership here locally? From this mayor, whose name is also Donald, he is very much like the nation's president in those same regards.
And I wanted to add to what Rodriguez is saying. Thousands of people also signed a citizens' initiative that Paso del Sur initiated following the city charter, and the mayor and the city council ignored it. They completely disregarded it. They didn't follow their own rules. They didn't put the issue up to a vote when thousands of citizens have voiced their opinion by signing this petition saying that they are against this project and they want the neighborhood to be preserved with a historical designation.
And I want to add to your question of a nonpartisan project of gentrification that destruction of the Mexican and Mexican-American communities have been taking place, well, for centuries. But let's talk about Segundo Barrio, for example. That was an initiative that was mainly supported by Democratic politicians and who are now campaigning to further their political career based on their supposed allegiance to the marginalized communities of El Paso, which is very ironic because they are very close to wealthy persons and groups who have established these campaigns pretty much terrorizing at the working class of El Paso, and of course, mainly the racialized sectors of this city. So it's true. It is a nonpartisan, racist, and elitist project.
John, I know we're just about out of time. I think we are out of time, but I think it's important that we're doing this story, especially for people in the Washington, D.C. area who will hear it today at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. People here won't know about El Paso. They won't know about the border. El Paso, the official population estimate is 683,000. That's within the city limits. When you look at the metropolitan area, it's over 1 million people. You know, Washington, D.C. is just about 700,000 people. So El Paso is not so much smaller than actually Washington, D.C. This is a big area. It's an important struggle. And obviously, the courts are preparing the ground for what will be an even bigger struggle. And the people in the community, like our guests, they're going to fight back.
They are going to fight back. We're going to leave it there. We were joined from El Paso by Rodriga, Cynthia, and Selfa, all organizers with Paso del Sur. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
It's Friday, so we will look at the week's worst and most misleading headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog, LeftEyeBlog.
You know, John, we're supposed to also talk about funny headlines, except we don't have any.
You know, that's the thing. In the age of Trump, it's hard to find funny headlines.
You wouldn't think so, but anyway, we don't have any, so it is false and misleading headlines this week.
I also want to welcome, though, our own Sputnik News analyst and producer of this show, Nicole Russell.
John, thank you.
Let's not forget Nicole. Okay.
Wow.
I'm here, too.
Hi, Steve.
Steve, it was actually a little hard to find funny headlines this week, but there was one about John McCain. The human rights community lost a champion, and that was in none other than the Washington Post. Go ahead, Steve.
Yes, I listed that under worst or most disgusting headlines, but it also qualifies as one of the funniest headlines, depending on your, you know, political point of view. Actually, there's a lot in this article. They claim that with the possible exception of the U.S. military, no group was more indebted to John McCain than the human rights community. Well, I would say the U.S. Military contractors were the most indebted to John McCain, but that's just an aside. Then they list some countries which where McCain was advocating for human rights, and one of them is Ukraine. And why this is funny is because the picture that Washington Post chose to use to go along with this article is a picture of McCain standing next to a neo-Nazi in Ukraine, whose name I will not pronounce correctly, but I'll try, as Oleh Tyanybok. And this guy is the founder of the neo-Nazi party in Ukraine. And among his more delightful quotes that I could find was he talked about once about the Moscow Jewish mafia ruling Ukraine. And he talked about how during the war they were fighting the Muscovites, Germans, Jews, and other scum. So this is the human rights champion that John McCain was delighted to pal around with.
Talk about changing the narrative, like completely a historical rewrite. I mean, John McCain voted against honoring Martin Luther King's birthday. He was, of course, flying as a volunteer many thousands of feet up in the air, dropping 2,000-pound bombs on Vietnamese villages. He was ultimately shot down, I think, for the third time. His plane was lost over a lake in Hanoi. He was bombing civilian areas in Hanoi. He was all about the Iraq War. Well, actually, Steve, he was about every war. I mean, there wasn't a war that John McCain wasn't for. And most of his criticisms of previous U.S. presidents was that the wars were not big enough. The bombing was not intense enough.
We needed surges of troops.
Yeah, that's the real John McCain. Go ahead.
And when we talk about human rights, the countries he picked on were, without exception, U.S. targets, U.S. enemies. The whole human rights talk from John McCain, as well as from the entire U.S. establishment, is strictly, as you, and to use your word, also Cindy Sheehan, to establish the so-called noble cause by which we, you know, should justify regime change and other sorts of interventions. He never criticized human rights in Saudi Arabia or Palestine. He never criticized the human rights, you know, the situation of Palestinians. Nothing like that. It's always U.S. enemies he's talking about, and it has nothing really to do with human rights at all. It has to do with justifying intervention and regime change.
Nicole, when Code Pink activists and other anti-war advocates went into the Senate Armed Services Committee in 2015 because they were protesting Henry Kissinger, who is, in fact, a war criminal. I mean, or at least, you know, a big part of the world believes that. This is what John McCain said to them. Get out of here, you low-life scum. You're going to have to shut up or I'm going to have you arrested. That's John McCain. When he was asked about it later, he stood for his words. He considers them low-life scum. The Vietnamese who he was bombing, he always referred to the Vietnamese with a racist epithet, the most disgusting racist epithet for the Vietnamese employed by U.S. troops, similar to what white people employed against black people with the N-word. I mean, that's how John McCain insisted on calling Vietnamese people who he bombed, but he was upset because they shot him down. They could have let him die in that lake. They didn't. He was taken prisoner, but I'm just guessing if some other country was bombing, say, Washington, D.C., and the pilot dropped into the Potomac, he probably would have been taken prisoner.
I think that's absolutely right. And that is, none of that information is in any of the mainstream articles about John McCain, and not even in the general kind of popular zeitgeist. I mean, Code Pink is an incredibly important organization that works on a range of different issues. They work on kind of making clear what's going on in Gaza, what's going on in Palestine. They talk about Yemen. They talk about all sorts of conflicts and places with real human rights abuses that aren't being talked about. They're the furthest thing from scum I can think of. And, you know, moreover, I think sometimes, occasionally, I've seen a couple posts here and there in social media about the racial slur he would use for Vietnamese. There are people out there who are excusing that because, you know, he did kind of suffer a little bit under while he was over there. But that doesn't justify using the words he does, and definitely not in the power seat that he's in. The one other thing that's really struck me this week is how both parties have really coalesced around the death of John McCain. Pretty much everybody but Trump was at his funeral. President Obama spoke at his funeral. Joe Biden led some of the services yesterday or earlier in the week. And, I think there are many who are seeing this as, it's the time to bridge the partisan nature of politics. But what I'm seeing this as, you know, all of the elite are coming together to support the things that John McCain supported, which is to say war.
Steve, let's go on to a couple other headlines. We just have a few minutes left.
Okay, well, let's do what I call a media story. This is about a Trump tweet, and this is an article from the Washington Post. I'll read the headline. FBI pushes back on unfounded Trump claim that China hacked Hillary Clinton's email. Now, this Trump claim was actually based on a Daily Caller story, which was itself totally based on anonymous sourcing. So you can call this story may be true, it may be false. I have absolutely no idea either way. But one thing it is not is unfounded. It has the same anonymous sourcing that countless stories in the Washington Post, the New York Times have. So it's kind of amusing in a way, or disgusting, for the Washington Post to be calling a story based on anonymous sourcing unfounded. It's just it's unproven for sure, but it's not unfounded. And the NBC News actually goes further. Their headline reads, FBI rebuts, I'll repeat the word, rebuts Trump tweet about China hacking Hillary Clinton's email. But if you read the article, and they say the FBI has not found any evidence that Clinton servers were compromised. But if you read a little further, the guy who did it, the FBI forensics agent, says he doesn't believe there's any way of determining 100% whether the servers had been compromised. And he felt, quote, fairly confident that there wasn't an intrusion. And when he asked whether a sophisticated foreign adversary was able to cover his tracks, he said, yeah, they could. So, again, I don't want to push this story and claim, you know, make anyone believe that China hacked Hillary Clinton's emails. Maybe they did. Maybe they didn't. I have no idea. But the way the media treats this, just because Trump was on this story and pushing it, they immediately jump all over him, which is funny. So this story was based on anonymous sourcing. That was tweeted out by Trump Wednesday night. Thursday morning, Trump sent out another tweet warning people not to read any stories based on anonymous sourcing because they're fiction. So he doesn't believe his own warnings.
Well, there's another headline here talking about Donald Trump's warnings. It says Donald Trump warns of violence. That's the part that's in quote, if Republicans lose the midterms. That's interesting headline. That's from The Guardian. Is that a threat of violence? What's anyway, what does that mean? Is that a misleading headline from The Guardian, or did Donald Trump actually say that?
Well, Donald Trump did say that in a tweet, but the amusing part is people he's referring to as violent are, get ready for it, congressional Democrats.
To the barricades.
They will overturn everything we've done, and they will do it quickly and violently. And violently, there's violence. That's a direct quote.
Let's go. We have 1 minute left. What's your last headline?
The final story is a New York Times story, and it's a serious one. The headline reads, Democratic embrace of diverse candidates collides with barbed politics of Trump era. Barbed politics, that's the New York Times euphemism for racism. As Adam Johnson from FAIR wrote, computer, pull up the most convoluted way of avoiding the word racist possible. This article includes such quotes as, Republicans are embracing messages with explicit appeals to racial anxieties and resentment. And racial discord has never been far from the surface of American politics.
That's always been the motivator for the KKK, for instance, racial anxiety. You know, we're out of time almost, but gosh, I'm just looking at this New York Times headline. It's across the entire page, page four today. Pause in joint exercises worry South Koreans. Like, and then it quotes all these retired South Korean generals who are worried that Donald Trump might not have another war exercise simulating the destruction of North Korea. I just wonder, John Kiriakou, how many of the South Koreans are really worried that the U.S. might not carry out war games?
Not a single normal South Korean was even interviewed for that article.
No.
We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined by Steve Padd. He joined us from the San Francisco Bay Area. Steve is an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog Left Eye on the News. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog. And we were joined here in the studio by Sputnik News producer Nicole Russell. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every Monday through Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, at iHeartRadio, and also at Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.